So tonight's talk is going to be about spiritual friendship, and the Pali word for a spiritual friend or a good friend is this word Kalyana Mitta, which I'm sure many of you know about already. It's a very common word in the Pali canon. You see it again and again and again, and when you read Buddhist texts, you come across this word very often. And quite literally, this word, Kalyana Mitta, I'm not going to give you a course in Pali or anything, but quite literally, it means good friend. That's basically what it means. But of course, in the world, we have all kinds of good friends. It doesn't just mean a good friend in the worldly sense. It means something much more profound than that. And that is why I call it like spiritual friendship. Because the purpose of Kalyana Mitta is not just to have somebody you can talk to, somebody you can chat with, somebody you can have a good time with. Is to have somebody who can support you in your spiritual life, no matter what way that support actually happens. So it is a very broad term, and it encompasses all kinds of support in your spiritual life. And to understand what I mean by support in the spiritual life, it is very useful just to consider the Buddhist society here in Perth, because the Buddhist society here gives you lots of support in your spiritual practice. And the first and most obvious support that you get here is that you have all these spiritual friends. All the people who come here every Friday night, all the people who are members of the Buddhist Society, people who keep the five precepts, people who practice well, who try to be kind and compassionate. And of course, the good thing about being with people like that is that they have similar aspirations to what you have. They think like you. They talk like you. They act like you. They are going in the same direction as you. And when everybody is going in the same direction, it's like it's almost like you get caught in the tailwind of everybody else, and you get pulled along together with the other people. Very often in the world, if you are with people who think differently from you, you have to struggle to actually withstand the pull which goes in the opposite direction of what you're doing. And it's very, can often be very tiring and very exhausting, because you have to restrain yourself. You have to be careful what you say. You have to be careful you don't get led along in the same way as the other people. But when you are with your spiritual friends, with the people around you, it's like you get into the slipstream and you just get pulled along in the same way. And this is one reason, one of many reasons, why monastic life is so powerful. Because in monastic life, of course, you're living all your time together with people who are doing roughly what you are doing here. So everybody's pulling everybody else along. And this is one of the beautiful things and one of the great things about monastic life when you live in a monastery like Bodhinyana Monastery or Dhammasara, that you have this kind of pulling in the same direction here. And one of the things that we need to be pulled about in our life is, of course, some often very simple things. Things like keeping the five precepts, for example, this foundational practice in Buddhism. And it can often be difficult for people to keep the five precepts. Let's start with the first one, just not killing any living beings. Now, why? What is difficult about that precept? Now, in essence, it seems quite easy, but there are many subtleties in that precept which actually are quite difficult. For example, what is the definition of a living being? How far down the scale of kind of microbes and bacteria and viruses do you have to go before you're dealing with a living being? And this is the sort of thing that you find out about by coming to a Buddhist society, coming to a place with a teacher about what actually a living being means. And then you're taught about different ideas about living beings. What living beings are, what is the kind of the distinction in terms of karma that you're acquiring, depending on the type of living being that you're dealing with. But even more complicated are questions such as euthanasia, questions such as abortion, questions like, we have stem cell research, all these kind of ethical dilemmas. And of course, by coming here, you do find out about how these things are practiced, how you can view them from a Buddhist point of view, and then you can actually practice accordingly. And this is a very important part of spiritual friendship, is actually coming to understand what these Buddhist teachings are about, what the foundations are like, what you can do and what you can't do, and not the least, why you can do certain things and why you can't. So this is very important. So that is Because the teachings can be difficult sometimes, particularly if you apply them to modern life, this is a very useful thing here. But there is also another aspect of the precepts, and that is can be maybe be very easily understood from the fifth precepts, not to drink any alcohol or take any intoxicating drugs, etc. Now that is often difficult for people, not because the concept is hard, it's very easy to understand what that means, but often it can be very difficult because the idea of drinking is so prominent in our society. Everybody drinks everywhere. And it's actually very hard sometimes. Your family may drink, your friends may drink, and to be like the sole person, the sore thumb who stands out from everybody else, is often very, very hard. There's so much pressure to be part of the culture that we're in. And of course, that is the great thing about having a spiritual friendship again, because you are with people who are thinking like you, or walking the same way like you. You don't always have to explain yourself, explain why you're not drinking. After a while, you get fed up having to tell people that you don't want to drink and why you don't do it. And there are, of course, all kinds of strategies that you can use. You know, the strategies like, you know, doctor's order, I can't drink, because the Buddha was often considered like a doctor in the suttas. It still feels a little bit wrong even to say that, because it's almost like you're being slightly deceptive by saying that. It's not really 100% honest. The other person doesn't really understand what you mean. So sometimes it's just so wonderful to be in the company of people who are going in the same way that you are going, pulling you along. Don't have to explain yourself, don't have to worry about anything, don't have to think about what other people think. And it makes life sometimes so much easier. And the remarkable thing about this Buddhist society here in Perth, if you have a look at the membership list, there is actually just about half the membership, which is about 500 people, keep all the five precepts. They are full members of the Buddhist society here. Now that is quite astounding. That is quite astonishing. That's a very, very large group of people who are keeping this precept. I don't think many people really understand and appreciate what a kind of a wholesome thing that is to have such a large group of people practicing in that way. It's really quite astonishing. And it reminds me in comparison, to understand the comparison, why it is so marvelous. Ajahn Brahm often tells a story when he was a monk in Thailand. And there's one story he tells, which is when Ajahn Shah, on the Uposatha night, on the full moon night or whatever, and all the lay people in the local village would come to the monastery. And sometimes there would be hundreds of these lay people coming to the monastery on the Uposatha night to hear, like, Ajahn Shah expounding the Dhamma and telling some good stories, I'm sure, etc., etc. And on one of these nights, Ajahn Shah asked the lay people, well, how many of you actually keep the five precepts? And it was a sea of people, you know, I don't know, probably much more than they see today, probably many hundreds. And there was about three or four people raised their hands keeping the five precepts. Now that tells you, that was in Thailand in those days, in a Buddhist society here, where people are supposed to practice Buddhism, and there's only three or four people doing it. And that shows you how amazing it is that here in Perth we actually have such a powerful and strong Buddhist community. It actually is something very special. And please don't take it for granted. Please don't think that this is the way it has to be. Very often it is not. And of course, at the end of that, when those three or four people raised their hand, Ajahn Shah was not very impressed, and he said something, you're all a bunch of, and he said some expletive, which I won't repeat it tonight, because I think they were very earthy character in those days in Thailand. They would sort of say things very directly. I'm not sure if it would go down so well, so well here, so I'll leave that out. But it was very kind of clear that, you know, these people were not living up to the standard that you're supposed to live up to as a Buddhist. So this is why, again, why it is so powerful to be part of this community, part of a community like this. It helps you, pulls you along in the right way. It teaches you the teachings, and it shows, and it actually gives you the opportunity to do things which otherwise would be very, very hard. And another thing which is important is that in a place like this, you start to understand the teachings of the Buddha for the first time. And the teachings of the Buddha can seem so complicated. You start reading the suttas and you wonder, gee, I don't really grasp what's going on here. There's five of this and four of that and eight of this and seven of this. And you practice a certain sequence. And you wonder what is actually happening here. How does all this fit together? And the point, of course, is, as I understand the Dhamma, it's almost like a jigsaw puzzle. You get all these lists and all these little pieces that you read about in the suttas, and then you fit it all together in a very kind of, in a beautiful way. And then you get this picture, and this picture is called the Dhamma. This is the Dhamma of the Buddha. And this is one of the wonderful things that you get in a place like this. You get an understanding of what these teachings actually are about. And ideally, the understanding you get is the very same thing that the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago. Not just something which has been made up by a monk or a nun or a lay teacher or whoever, but actually you get to understand what the Buddha himself taught 2,500 years ago. And that is very, very important. And what is it that you learn about the Buddha's teachings? How do you understand these teachings? And there is a very simple way of understanding the whole teachings. This jigsaw puzzle is really one thing, and that is the purification of a person. Purifying yourself, the whole practice of Buddhism, the Eightfold Path, the gradual training, the five spiritual faculties, all these things are about one thing, purification, purifying yourself. The path of purification, it is sometimes called the Buddha's teachings. So that is a summary of the Buddha's teachings, and that is what you hopefully you should learn in the Buddhist society here. But then there's one more thing, which also is a reason why this Buddhist society or spiritual friendship, Kalanamitta, is so powerful. And this comes from a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Greater Sutta, the Greater Discourse on Emptiness, Majjhima 122, if you want to look it up. And very interesting, in this sutta, the Buddha says to Ananda, Ananda is the Buddha's attendant, the chief attendant of the last 20 years of his life. And the Buddha says to Ananda, Ananda, don't come to me to learn more discourses, to learn more answers to questions, to learn more verse and all these things. That is not why you should come to me, because you have been learning these things for so long already. Basically, you already have that intellectual understanding of what Buddhism is all about. So why should you come to me? You should come to me to get inspired about the Dhamma, to get inspired about practicing virtue, to get inspired about practicing restraint, putting forth effort, finding seclusion, and all these other things. That is why you should come to me to hear the Dhamma. And it is a bit like that for all Buddhists. This is one thing which is very, very important in our lives. Sometimes we can understand the doctrines, we can understand all the concepts of Buddhism. It is not that difficult to understand, particularly when you see that whole jigsaw puzzle coming together. But sometimes we need inspiration. We need somebody to give us a little kick in the bottom so that we can actually get a move on and do the things that we need to do. And that is one of the main reasons why a Buddhist society, this is so important. Like coming here, because it gives you that reminder of what you're supposed to be doing, and it gives you the inspiration in the heart to get out there and do what is right, to do what is good, and to purify yourself and to be a blessing for the world, essentially. So this is one of the very important functions of this Buddhist society, of Kalyanamitta, of having good friends and good friendships in this world. So, you probably have some idea now how important it is to have Kalyanamittas, to have good friends. You can see the whole specter here of things. And you're probably also beginning to understand why it was the Buddha himself who is the best of spiritual friends. Why is the Buddha the best of spiritual friends? Because without him, there wouldn't be any Buddhism. And we can assume that the most profound statement of the Buddha's teachings comes from the Buddha himself. So that's why he's the best of friends, because he's the one, more than anybody else, who pulls us along and moves us out of suffering towards contentment and happiness. Now, to really understand how important the Kalyanamitta is in the Buddha's teaching, it's very useful to compare the idea of good friendship to other qualities that the Buddha talked about. And you find that in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, in the beginning there, the Buddha talks about certain qualities that are like foundational qualities for the spiritual life. Qualities without which you cannot really even get started on the spiritual path. And to give you some idea what qualities the Buddha is talking about here, one of them is appamada, which I'm sure many of you already know that word. Apamada is usually translated as heedfulness. And what does heedfulness mean? Heedfulness means like you are careful, you are circumspect, you are awake, you are aware, you look at things. You don't actually just look at things in a superficial way, but you are careful with how you, what you do things. You don't just go around in the world in a kind of a stupor, intoxicated by all the pleasures of the world, but you're actually careful with how you live your life. You can see why heedfulness is so important. If you are not careful with how you live your life, how on earth are you even going to be able to live a virtuous lifestyle? How are you going to be able to stop yourself from getting angry when you feel like getting angry? How are you going to be able to stop yourself from telling somebody off when you feel like telling them off and it may not be the right time? So heedfulness is obviously a very foundational quality. Without that, there cannot really be any progress at all on the path. Indeed, the very last thing that the Buddha said to his disciple before he passed away was, strive on with heedfulness. In other words, this is like the kind of, almost like a summary of the Buddha's teaching, the idea of striving on with heedfulness. So there you can see, that's one of these foundational qualities. Another of these foundational qualities is called in Pali, yoniso manasikara. And this means like wise attention. So you have to be wise in Buddhism. Wisdom is one of these very important words in the Buddhist teachings. So you have to attend to things in the wise way. What does that mean? It means that you don't just accept things for what they look like on the surface. If you accept things for what they look like on the surface, then you always run around trying to satisfy your cravings. It's very obvious when you desire something. The first thing that comes into your mind, okay, I desire something, I got to satisfy this. But of course, in Buddhism, we don't think like that. We think, well, wait a minute, is it really going to satisfy me? What's going to happen when that craving disappears? Maybe if I get this thing I'm desiring, what happens afterwards? Another desire rises and on it goes forever. Or perhaps I don't get it and I suffer because I can't get it. Is this really the way to go? And this is like yoniso manasikara. You reflect wisely on how you should be living your life. The opposite is ayoniso manasikara. Non-wise reflection. It means like following your desires, running around, not really thinking about being virtuous, kind and compassionate, and basically living a silly life. That is the opposite of that. And you can see again why that must be so important in your practice. Unless you are wise, unless you think carefully, how on earth can you get anywhere on the spiritual path? Basically, you can't. Another of these foundational qualities is putting forth energy. You have to put forth energy in Buddhism. If you are lazy, if all you do is sit on your bottom and you don't get up and you don't actually put forth an effort to try to think differently, to try to be kind, to try to be compassionate, again, laziness is always the opposite of success in the spiritual life. If you are too lazy, it means that you follow your defilements as they come up, because there's no resistance inside of you to stop them or to go in a different direction. So again, having a sense of energy, like spiritual energy, energy of the mind, which points you in the right direction, obviously is a very foundational quality. So these are foundational qualities in the Buddhist teaching that the Buddha specifically pointed out. Now, if you have these qualities, what does that mean? What it means is that you will tend to reduce the unwholesome states in your mind, and you will tend to increase the good or the wholesome states inside of you. And that is one of the beautiful definitions of anything which matters in Buddhism, an increase in the wholesome and a decrease in the unwholesome. And you can see how that is basically what I said before. It's about the purification of the person, the purification of conduct, the purification of mind is essentially a summary of what the Buddha's teaching is all about. And in each of these cases, these qualities, these foundational qualities, do just that. They reduce the unwholesome and they increase the wholesome. Now, along with these qualities I have just mentioned, is also spiritual friendship. Kalyanamitta is one of these qualities. It is one of these few foundational qualities in Buddhism that are there at the very beginning and are absolutely necessary for the spiritual life even to take off, even to be possible in the first place. That is how important spiritual friendship is. It is there together with this handful of qualities. Without it, there is no improvement in wholesome states. There is no decrease in unwholesome states. It is absolutely essential. How how can it be understood that it is so essential here? And here I want to talk about one very famous statement by the Buddha, which I'm sure many of you have heard about before. It is very well known, and it is something which is very important. And it's important to understand what this statement actually means. And this statement is where the Venerable Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, he goes up to the Buddha and he says to the Buddha, Bhagava, Blessed One, spiritual life is half, no sorry, good friendship is half of the spiritual life, he says to the Buddha. And the Buddha, of course, replies that many of you, I'm sure, will know, no, Ananda, spiritual friendship is not half of the spiritual life. Spiritual friendship is the entirety of the spiritual life. That is a very remarkable statement, because you might think, well, I mean, how can it be all of the spiritual life? Surely there's many other things in the spiritual life. You have to be compassionate, you have to be kind, you have to be virtuous, you have to be wise, you have to practice meditation, you have to be peaceful. All these things that we should practice, how can spiritual friendship be everything? How is that possible? And to understand how this is possible, you have to go back to one of the very essential things which are the Buddhist teachings. This is the teaching of non-self. And that is where you can understand why spiritual friendship is everything in the spiritual life. The non-self idea, what that actually means when you understand it in all its profundity, in all its depth, what it means is that you are not an agent inside of yourself who decides to go this way or that way, but you are conditioned, not only a little bit conditioned, you are completely conditioned by external forces and internal forces around you. So the forces around you are what decide how you're going to live your life. It is not some entity inside of you which is independent of everything else and says, okay, I'm going to go this way, just following my own understanding and intuition. No, that's impossible. It can't be like that, according to the Buddha's teachings. It's impossible to have that independence, because there is nothing inside of you which is separate from an entity which is separate from everything else. Everything is just conditioned by everything else. And for that reason, it matters enormously who you have as your friends, who you hang out with, who you listen to, what kind of teachings you get into the mind. It matters absolutely 100%. And without the right teachings, you will basically be going down the wrong way. You'll be led up the garden path, as I say, because you're not able to withstand it, because you don't have anything else to show you the right way. There's nothing inside of you to withstand these things. You are 100% conditioned. And that is why spiritual friendship is so incredibly important, because it points you in the right direction. It makes you go the right way. And the Buddha then said to Venerable Ananda, he said that it is based on spiritual friendship that you practice the Eightfold Path. Without spiritual friendship, you don't practice the Eightfold Path. It is based on spiritual friendship. He says in particular, it is based on friendship with me, the Buddha says, that people make an end of suffering in this world. Without that spiritual friendship, you don't make an end of suffering. And it's one of the foundational things which enables you to enter and understand the Buddha's teaching is to hear that teaching from the suttas, from the Buddha himself, or from somebody else who understands those teachings. Without that, it is basically impossible. So for this reason, this is why the Buddha said that spiritual friendship is everything in the spiritual life. Because without it, you wouldn't be going anywhere. You would be stuck, and it would be impossible for you to even get started. And now you can start to get the feeling for the power of spiritual friendship, for the importance of this, for how incredibly lucky and fortunate you are to be part of a Buddhist society like this, to have people you can practice with around you, a large group of people, all keeping the five precepts. You also have many talented teachers here, people who are lay and monastic coming here, of both genders. And that is a wonderful, wonderful thing, because it is so difficult to find these things in the world. And most important of all, you have the suttas of the Buddha, You can read what the Buddha himself said, and you can compare everything you learn with what the Buddha himself said to make sure that there is no deviation from these things. This is very, very important. One of the problems I always see in the Buddhist world is that there is too much people following along what the teachers say. The teacher says this, and you go along it. And this is often called the Acharya Vada in Buddhism. Acharya means teacher, and Vada is like the doctrine of the teacher. And the Acharya Vada is like the opposite of the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings. The Acharya Vada is where you have a teacher, and you follow that teacher unquestioningly, without actually finding out for yourself what the Buddha himself taught. And it's so important that you have that stability, that rudder in your life, that thing which guides you in the right way, because you never know what these acharyas, what these teachers say. You don't know what I'm teaching you here is complete rubbish. It might be. Check up the suttas that I have talked about and see if the Buddha actually said these things, and see if what I'm saying actually makes sense. And hopefully it will make sense. Otherwise, I'll be very embarrassed if you can point out some really serious mistake in what I've been saying. But check it out. It is so important. And I feel one of the great, it is really one of the incredible weaknesses of Buddhism. So many places around the world, people don't really understand what the Buddha taught, neither in the suttas nor in the Vinaya. And because of that, they make enormous amounts of mistakes. They follow the wrong people. They practice the Vinaya in the wrong way. And they end up making enormous, really, really serious mistakes in terms of how they relate to other monks, how they relate to each other, etc. Because of that. So it is very important. So my point is that your highest, your most important Kalyanamitta always is the Buddha. He is the one that really matters. He is the final arbiter who decides what is and what is not Buddhism, and that is where you should go to find your final and ultimate inspiration. So this is the path, this is the Kalyanamitta, and to make this work for you in your life as part of the Buddha Society, you will have noticed that when I started off this talk during the meditation, I tried to bring everybody here into the meditation. I try to focus on the good qualities of the people in this room. And I recommend you to do that. Try, even when you go home, try to remind yourself of the good qualities of the people in the Buddha Society here. They're not perfect. Very few people in this world are perfect. But they are trying. They're trying to do something which very, very few people in the world actually do try. And that is worthy of so much admiration, so much praise that people do this. So reflect on that you have all these wonderful spiritual friends. And the benefit of that is not only is the benefit that you develop something beautiful inside of yourself, you enhance and make it much more powerful, the metta that you have. But the beauty is also that you get a lot of harmony inside the Buddha Society when you practice in this way. And that sense of harmony is so important for progress in meditation. If you haven't got harmony, if there's a sense of like conflict and negativity, and you can't get along with the people around you, meditation never, never takes off. This is also found in the suttas. There is a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where the Buddha says precisely this. When there is disharmony, meditation becomes basically impossible. So build up that harmony, build up that friendship, that sense of looking upon each other with eyes of loving kindness, blending, as it says in the suttas, like milk and water. And then you get a beautiful practice for yourself and also a very beautiful Buddhist society and Buddhist group. And not only should the lay people do that, but it's also true that this should also be done by the monastics. The Buddha says in the sutta that one of the most important people as a monk or a nun that you should have loving kindness towards are your fellow monastics. This is in the Kosambya Sutta, Majjhima 48. And he says that you should have loving kindness in action, in words, and in mind, both openly and also privately. When you go back to yourself, you should still have loving kindness towards these people. And then when you practice in that way, you get a wonderful sense of harmony and cooperation, and the spiritual life becomes really possible. So please, don't take the Kalyanamittas you have, don't take them for granted. Realize how lucky you are to have this wonderful spiritual community here. It is extremely rare in the world to have so many people practicing so well. It is a wonderful thing. and reflect on that and make sure that you don't waste that opportunity make something out of that Kalyanamitta group. The Buddha said in another sutta, he said that there is something called the reflection on the Kalyanamitta. And that reflection is, oh, what a gain it is for me. Oh, how fortunate I am to have so many good spiritual friends in life. This is the recollection of Kalyanamittas. And that gives rise to a sense of happiness and gladness inside of you. And that is one of the important foundation stones for meditation to work. Okay, so that is my talk on Kalyanamitta and spiritual friendship. So if you would like, there's lots of time left. It's quite a short talk. So if you anybody would like to ask any questions about the topic tonight or any other topic which you might want to talk about, please do so. This is the right time. Anybody have any things they want to bring up? Any comment about anything? Or yes? You want me to talk about eating meat? Okay. Well, the eating of meat, there is for a monastic, I start off for the monastic, what we can do as monastics, and the only kind of meat that we can't eat as monastics is meat of animals that have been specifically killed for us. If we think that an animal may have been killed for us, if we think or we know it has been killed for us, then we can't eat that meat. And the point, of course, of that is basically that we're not allowed to, we shouldn't encourage the lay supporters to kill animals for our sake. That's basically the point there. But beyond that, the Buddha does not actually forbid the eating of meat. In fact, it is one of the interesting stories in the Vinaya is where the Devadatta, who was the Buddha's cousin, he goes to the Buddha and he wants to split the Sangha. He wants to take his part of the Sangha to go one way and then for the Buddha to keep everybody else. Now, one of the criteria that the Buddha laid down for splitting the Sangha, he said that, well, I say that there should be no meat eating in the Sangha. That was one of the things. And the Buddha actually rejected that. He said that is not the way that this Sangha should work. So basically, there isn't any in the, I would say, in the early suttas, there is nothing there that says that meat eating itself is wrong. There is, it's true, there is, if you go to Mahayana Buddhism, there are, you know, certain schools where people are told basically they shouldn't eat meat, but that apparently comes from something else. It's apparently a cultural thing which has been added to that those particular Buddhist schools. It doesn't actually come from the Buddha himself. Now you may think that, well, how can it be that, you know, we shouldn't kill animals on the one hand, and yet we are allowed to actually eat meat on the other hand? And I think the answer there is simply that it is the act of killing itself, that intention that you have when you pull the trigger of that gun, or you let go of that arrow, as it did at the time of the Buddha. That act, when you know that I am now killing this living being, and that is the problematic one. That is the one which is really heavy karma, if you like, from Buddhist point of view. But the thing of, you know, buying meat of an animal which has already been killed, it's a different category here. You could argue, and many people do, and of course it's true, that you're supporting the meat industry by doing that. Of course that is true. But it is still a different category because you don't actually have that intention yourself of killing the animal. And that is an enormous difference, having that intention directly and just buying the meat. And of course the point is that the meat industry, whether you buy the meat or not, it will still go on because there are people out there who don't have any compunction about killing animals. I think it's okay to kill animals. You know, I mean, most people don't have a problem with that. And because there are people who don't have problem with eating animals, rather, you know, you're not going to stop that by stopping to eat meat. The only way you can stop other people from not killing animals is to teach them that it actually is inappropriate. So if you really want other people to stop killing, rather than not buying meat, I would say it's much more effective to actually try to convince people that this actually is the wrong way of going about things. And then you're actually doing something really positive, because then you are helping people to create good karma instead. That's a long answer to a short question. Did I answer it the way you wanted, or? Yeah. Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I think, you know, very often there are lots of moral dilemmas in the world. And, you know, if people feel that they want to be vegetarians and they don't want to eat meat, I think, great, do that. You know, I'm never going to say to people, don't be vegetarian. I think that is sort of not correct either. I think if you want to do that and you feel it makes you feel good, it makes you feel that you're doing something right, and not just in a self-righteous way, but you actually do really feel good about yourself, then I think wonderful. By all means, be a vegetarian. And I know even Ajahn Brahm was a vegetarian before he became a monk. One of the ironies of becoming a monk, particularly in Northeast Thailand at the time when Ajahn Brahm became a monk, was that he had to give up being a vegetarian. He couldn't be a vegetarian anymore. He came in as a vegetarian, and suddenly all he got was, you know, sticky rice and basically meat, animal products. There wasn't really any much vegetables available. So, you know, you had to actually give it up. But the point is, I think, and this is the also like with swatting a mosquito. If you do swat a mosquito, you know, the way to overcome that sort of thing is to remind yourself that this is a living being that desires to live. You know, and the more you can empathize with the idea of being a mosquito, the more you have to sort of anthropomorphize a little bit and think of yourself, see the human characteristics almost in that mosquito. It wants to live. It wants to be happy just like you. Then it becomes, if you reflect like that, it becomes easier to overcome the desire to kill the mosquito. But of course, you know, there's many, many things in Buddhism. You know, karma is a very complicated subject. And, you know, if you kill a mosquito, it's not the same thing as killing a human being. These things are very different. Yeah, that's right. So it is worse karma than killing a mosquito, indeed, you know. So, yeah, quite right. So, yeah, that's why you have to be careful. So, indeed. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, it is, you know, generally speaking, it is a very, everything in about karma in Buddhism is about intention and motivation. Why are you doing what you're doing? This is extremely important. So if we're talking about killing, it is very, very important how you do the killing. It certainly matters a lot. And that's why we sometimes talk about euthanasia. I mean, euthanasia, is it bad or is it good? And it really depends on your mind state when you do that sort of thing here. If you are able to come from pure compassion, it's not easy to come from pure compassion, but if you're able to do that, then you are creating good karma, even with euthanasia. I'm not saying that you should do it. I'm not saying that it's possible to do it completely purely. But what I'm saying is that it is intention that matters. And the same thing if you kill an animal. There are many different ways you can kill an animal. You can just be callous and cold-hearted, and you can shoot an animal because you don't like it or whatever, you're angry. And of course, in those cases, it is bad karma. But let's say that you are a hunter and you see there's lots of animal in the forest and some of them are very weak. And you think, well, if I shoot a couple of them, maybe the other ones will survive because there's been a harsh winter or whatever. And if you think like that, then the karma isn't so strong anymore. It's a different type of karma altogether. So it all depends on your intention. Intention is extremely important. Now, the idea of sacredness, that reminds me a little bit of animal sacrifice, because animal sacrifice is a very large thing in all kind of ancient societies. At the time of the Buddha, that was also a very big part of the Hindu society in those days. But basically, even though for them it was like a sacred act and it was to sort of appease the gods or whatever, even though it was that, they created enormous amounts of suffering for these animals, for the people who had to sort of, you know, do the slaughtering and all these things. And because of that, it was always negative and bad karma in those cases. And the Buddha said, oh, this is not the way to have a sacrifice. This is not how you should sacrifice things. Sacrifice should be an offering to somebody. It should be like an act of generosity. You offer food to somebody, you offer kindness, a helping hand or whatever. That is the real sacrifice coming from the heart, not killing animals. There's a very primitive, really, idea, that this idea that you're going to appease the gods by killing something, you know, whether it's a human being or an animal. And yet, even today, you find this happening in the world, this kind of ideas. I don't think that really works, even though you have a kind of sacred idea about it. I don't think that will sort of cancel out the bad karma in that particular case. Yes. Okay. Well, one of the good things is that you have the internet, for example, you know. So the internet is now supposed to be everywhere in Australia with this kind of, soon anyway, with this kind of broadband rollout or whatever they call it. So you have there is an access there. And I know that there are many people who live really far away and in places where there is no Buddhism and who really enjoy the talks and the, you know, things that come from the Buddhist society here. And that is, in a sense, their spiritual community. You can have a lot of spiritual community online these days. I know about there's a man who is an Ajahn Brahm disciple, and he lives in, I think, Alabama or something. And this is like the, you know, deep south in the U.S., very, very Christian, very fundamentalist often. So he feels pretty lonely down there, you know. There isn't many friends. But he has the internet. He has access to these talks. And Ajahn Brahm is like his teacher. So that is one very good, very, very helpful thing here. But of course, you know, if you are very serious about your spiritual practice, and this is one of the things that I think the Buddha comes back to again and again in the suttas, is that whatever choices you make in life, where, you know, when you choose where you want to live, for example, that choice should always be based on one criteria only. Is it going to lead to my spiritual improvement or not? Am I going to improve in wholesome states and decline in unwholesome states? Then that is the right choice. So I would say that if you live in a place where it is very difficult because people don't think like you and people go in a different direction and you feel that you're missing out on that sense of spiritual community and spiritual friendship, then it actually is not wrong to even consider moving from that place and moving somewhere else if you think it is really going to be beneficial. It is not wrong. And I think that as a general principle, it's a wonderful principle to use in life to decide all kind of choices. What you're going to do with yourself, where you're going to work, who you're going to be your friends, where you're going to live, what kind of religion you're going to follow. Almost anything in life can be brought back to that one very simple question. Is it going to be for my spiritual benefit or is it not? Am I going to become a better person, more compassionate, more kind, more wholesome, more virtuous? Then it is the right choice, otherwise it's not. The Buddha said the same thing for monks. If you live in a community like in Serpentine, or I guess it's true for lay people as well, if you have a teacher who helps you to improve in the wholesome qualities, you should stay with that teacher. In fact, the Buddha went so far, and I should probably have said this in my talk, because it's a very important point about Kalyanamitta, really. He went so far as to say that even if that teacher asks you to leave, but you know that you're benefiting from being with that teacher, you should still not leave from that teacher. You should almost like hold on, cling on to that teacher without leaving. Of course, you can only do that so much. There comes a point when you have to go because, you know, it becomes too difficult. But the point is that the whole purpose of the spiritual life is purifying yourself. It's improving in good qualities and declining in bad qualities. So if you are fulfilling that spiritual life, then you should continue doing what you are doing already. Yeah. That's the thing there. Yeah.